Welcome. This is Cliff Dunning, your host for Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. It is Saturday, 24th of May, and if you're in the United States, we are celebrating the beginning of Memorial Day weekend, so I imagine that people are relaxed and enjoying their time off. Hopefully, you're having some time off. I'm broadcasting today from Oakland, and it is a beautiful day. It's a good start for the weekend. The subject for today is actually understanding cycles in ancient history. And as an archaeological investigator myself, I've always tried to figure out what the level of consciousness was in or is in some of these ruins. And how do we explain the pyramids of Giza, Pumapunku in South America, and Göbekli Tepe in Turkey? These are structures that are very sophisticated, dated thousands of years ago before our understanding of history, and they are anomalies when we look at our current history, which if you hear from traditional archaeologists, basically starts with Mesopotamia. Before that is hunter-gatherers and basically proto-humans or early humans. So today we are going to talk about a fascinating book called The Yugas. And our guest today is Joseph Selby. And together with David Steinmetz, they have written a book that is a focal point, I think, for understanding ancient civilizations. And not just understanding them, getting an idea of what their level of consciousness was and what was happening on the earth. The full title of the book is The Yugas, Keys to Understanding Our Hidden Past, Emerging Energy Age, and Enlightened Future. I was introduced to this book about 6 months ago, and I didn't really think too much about it until I read it, and I'm still a bit challenged by some of the concepts, but hopefully our guest today will help us with this. So let me briefly introduce our guest. Joseph Selby studied ancient Western cultures at the University of Colorado and ancient Eastern cultures at UC Berkeley. He has a keen interest in ancient history since grade school. He has taught and lectured on the principles of Eastern philosophy for over 30 years. Joseph, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you briefly tell us about how you came to understand the Yugas and explain your take on it, because the Yugas have been out. There's a basic understanding of them, but you take the point of view from Sri Yukeshwar, who is a sage from India, who wrote The Holy Science, and you use his foundation, his book, as a kind of a general pathway, would you call it, for the book The Yugas that you've written. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, I read that book with great interest, the book you alluded to, The Holy Science, when I was going to school at Berkeley. And it was utterly fascinating to me because it provided answers to a lot of these mysteries, as you've already pointed out, such as the Great Pyramids and some of these other structures like Göbekli Tepe that don't seem to fit in with mainstream archaeology's point of view. And I was well aware of those kind of anomalies back then. When I read the book, it just clicked that the past could be explained more completely, not necessarily by there having been higher technology in the past, but by there having been higher awareness, higher consciousness in the past. And that's really the premise of the whole idea that we could have a cycle of history, a cycle of development, is that in the distant past, through remote influences that sort of flow through our solar system, man's awareness was more subtle, more expanded, more in tune with spirit than it is today. And what Sri Yukteswar said is that the peak of that higher consciousness last occurred in 11,500 BC, and that it reached its lowest point in 500 AD, a stretch of 12,000 years between the peak and the low point. And then it will again return to that high level of consciousness in 12,500 AD, and that this cycle will just keep going indefinitely. So where we find ourselves is kind of on the beginning of the ascent back to this higher level of consciousness. So that, in a nutshell, is the notion of the yugas. Now, where I really picked it up in terms of my interest and the way I approached writing the book is to ask the question, if this is a real pattern, a real influence, then we ought to be able to see the footprint of it, that the different structures, the mythology, the languages, the approaches to doing things that we can identify in the ancient past ought to match up to these changing levels of consciousness that Sri Yukteswar said were true. And I found, to my great satisfaction and delight, that there was an extremely good matchup to what he said happened in the past and what he predicts will occur in the future. And that's really the core of the book, is finding that footprint.
Okay, well, let's talk about Yukteswar a little bit. Tell us about him. He wrote this amazing book, The Holy Science, in the turn of the century, 1899, I believe. Is that correct? Very late, very early. And
Actually, 1894.
And tell us about this book and how it influences his thought. And also, I guess my biggest fascination is, and I have to say I haven't read it, I need to get it and read it, but he actually predicts some cycles that are fascinating. So can you just talk a little bit about this man and his influence in the book, in your book?
Sure. Well, Sri Yukteswar lived in the late 1800s. He died in 1936. He was the spiritual teacher of Paramahansa Yogananda, who many people know by his famous book, The Autobiography of a Yogi. And Sri Yukteswar wrote this very small but incredibly condensed book in terms of, you know, the amount of information it contains, knowledge it contains. He wrote it in 1894, as already mentioned. And most of the book is a very profound description of the higher potentials of all people. And he really describes the spiritual nature of everyone and how we can sort of work through where we are now with as he would describe it, a kind of an over-identification with the physical, and change our center of awareness to more subtle realities that are with us all the time. We're just not paying attention to them. You know, we are inherently those spiritual beings. So that most of the book is about that. But the introduction to the Holy Science is where he describes the notion of the yugas. And in there, he talks about not only this large cycle, which I've already explained, but he says that we go through specific sort of stages or phases in that 12,000-year ascent, and then we reverse, go through the stages in reverse for the 12,000-year descent. And those stages are, in stating it quickly, a sort of a material age, an energy age, a mental age, and then finally a spiritual age.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find this notion of there being ages where mankind's overall consciousness is very distinctly different. You'll find this notion in every ancient culture around the world. Mm-hmm. Probably the one most people are familiar with is the Greek idea of the Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age. But it exists in North American, Native American, Indian mythology. It exists in Egyptian mythology. It exists in the Norse mythology.
Mm-hmm.
It's so prevalent that it's pretty clear that ancient man all embraced this notion that there had been higher ages in the past.
Okay.
And so those characteristics of each age, the material, really, according to Sri Yukteswar, characterized the period from about 700 BC to 1700 AD.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1700 AD, we moved into our present phase, which he would characterize as an energy age. This is a time when mankind as a whole begins to understand and use the knowledge that energy underlies all matter, and that energy is the key power that shapes our physical world.
Okay.
You can certainly see this sort of exploitation in the last, 100 to 200 years.
Right. We're going to definitely get into these ages, but I want to get the foundation. And one of the questions I have for you is, where did he? He was a sage, so Yukteswar was basically read through the Vedic literature, and of course the understanding of the yugas has been around for many hundreds of years, thousands of years. I mean, as a general piece of literature, how long has it been around?
Well, the core concept of the yugas, the oldest reference to it is in the Vedas, and mm-hmm. depending on whose dating you prefer, that could be anywhere from 1500 BC to what I prefer, much later dating, as late as 7000 BC. That the Vedas were conceived. They weren't written down probably until 1500 BC, but they were an oral tradition for a very long time before that. So that's the first kind of sort of factual expression of the mm-hmm. yugas, and that's really what Sri Yukteswar draws upon. Now in India today, there is a widespread knowledge of and thought that the yuga cycle is much, much bigger than the 24,000-year cycle that Sri Yukteswar mentions. And mm-hmm. this may, in fact, be a mistaken interpretation of the Vedas. Sri Yukteswar says it is. It could also be a larger cycle yet. If you do any study of Indian philosophy, you will find that they have cycles within cycles, phases within phases. They have a very, very subtle way of explaining how the physical and the astral and the mental universes work together to create mm-hmm. what we have. So in either case, that the tradition has been around for, as you say, thousands of years. And Sri Yukteswar, you could say, is a modern proponent, sort of his purpose was to clarify the nature of the yugas, and particularly to point out how we had moved recently from the darker Kali Yuga, as it's called, into the energy age of the Dwapara Yuga.
Okay, so what I want you to explain to our audience is that the concept that some in India are using is a different yugas than what Sri Yukteswar explains. And he says there's a correction in the calculations. Is that what it is? Or there's a issue with his version of what he sees the time cycle is and what the general perception is. Is that correct?
Yeah, and putting it simply, what he said is that toward the 700 BC, 500 BC, or excuse me, 900 BC era, there was a decision made, an erroneous decision, according to Sri Yukteswar, that the number of years that are referred to in the Vedas, which, by the way, add up to 24,000 years, but the decision was taken erroneously that those were not normal years. Those were years of the gods. A much, much longer time for each year. So basically, just by multiplication, they ended up with a conception of the yuga cycle being millions of years rather than thousands of years.
Okay.
So that's the simplest way to explain what Sri Yukteswar says. But it's also fair to say, as I said earlier, that there are also in the Vedas, in the scriptures that interpret the Vedas, there are references to much longer cycles that are similar. They just have a bigger time frame by far than the 24,000-year cycle.
Okay. So let's get down to it. In its most basic form, tell us what the yugas are, and if you can, identify the periods with the times, the dates, if you can.
Okay, well, let's start with the lowest age, since we came out of that recently. According to Sri Yukteswar, the lowest age, Kali Yuga, the material age, lasted from 700 BC to 1700 AD. This is, ironically, what we think of as recorded history for the most part. And a lot of our theories of human development, a lot of our attitudes towards how man, you know, developed are based on our knowledge of that period of time. But this was a very brutal and heavy age. This is the age of widespread slavery. This is the age of religious intolerance. This is not a great time if you look closely at the history of that era. But if we go back before 700 BC, according to Sri Yukteswar, 700 BC was the end of this Dwapara age, which began in 3100 BC, so 2400 years long.
Okay.
And that was characterized by a more subtle awareness of energy, not the sort of splitting the atom kind of awareness that we have in our upswinging cycle of the yuga cycle, but more of a subtle inner energy. This was the era of what has been sort of pejoratively now described as the era of magic. But the interesting thing is that during that era, magic worked. It's pretty much dismissed now as just being the misguided understanding of ignorant people. But in fact, mm-hmm. if you really dig into the records that were left from that era, magic was the technology of the age, and
okay.
worked extremely well. So one of the more intriguing things, you would think that the sort of Judeo-Christian tradition would be implacably opposed to magic. And yet, if you read the passage about Moses and his brother confronting the Egyptian priests,
mm-hmm.
the Egyptian priests turn their staffs into snakes. And rather than Moses, you know, rising up and condemning them for being magicians, he turns his staff into a snake, and it defeats theirs. In other words,
yes, I remember that scene from the movie Moses very well.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, there could be subtle inner meanings going on there, but there's also the every likelihood, since magic was so prevalent in that time, that he was just showing that the magic of what he had to teach was just as powerful as what the Egyptian priests had to teach.
But when you look say magic, into, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that one of the ways that we really can see how it was wound into daily life in mm-hmm. Those ancient cultures are the medical health and healing kind of treatises that come to us from that era, which includes Ayurveda. It includes a lot of papyri from Egypt. It includes ancient Chinese medicine. And if you look closely at them, not only do they have far more anatomical knowledge than mainstream archaeology can explain. You know, they knew things like there was cerebrospinal fluid, and they had trauma medicine, they had antibiotics in the form of herbal poultices, they could do cesarean sections, they had a fairly highly sophisticated awareness of the physical body, which traditionally now is considered to only have been discovered in the, you know, like medieval era in mm-hmm. in the West. But they had that. But not only did they have that, but woven in with all that knowledge, they also included subtle energy awareness, like acupuncture. There were acupuncture.
Yeah, the meridians.
Fields.
They knew about the meridians, yes. too, I guess. Yeah.
They knew about how to manipulate subtle energy inside the body to affect healing. And mm-hmm. this is a seems like a big new discovery here today, but in fact what we're doing is, because we're moving into the same level of consciousness that they had in that past bygone age,
mm-hmm.
but the consciousness is the same, and we're discovering the same principles and kind of leveraging this ancient knowledge to go deeper into it ourselves.
Okay, so, now, what's the inception date for this period we're talking about now, starting point?
3100 B.C.
3100 B.C., and so you're saying that the, and how, from your perspective, do we describe the consciousness? Because it must be pretty sophisticated to perceive meridians, the Chinese perceiving meridians, to work with antibiotics that are more compounds from natural substances, which means that you have a focus on the natural earth, the earth itself, rather than chemical or a pharmaceutical approach. So that's an unusual state of consciousness, wouldn't you say? Or what's the definition?
No, I think that's, in our terms, from what people are like today, that's an unusual state of consciousness. And I think that in time, we too, as a civilization, as a world society, are going to see more and more people who have that kind of awareness as we progress forward into that same consciousness. But in the past, in that, let's say, the middle, the heart of that period of Dwapara Yuga, it was every man's consciousness. Mm-hmm. And that they could feel subtle energy. They could be aware of subtle energy just as easily as we are aware of things that we discover through our senses. And that because they were real, they were able to manipulate them. And, you know, as I say, that's sort of their inner technology of the age. I think it's also a bit of a clue, big clue, for why the Great Pyramids were built. I believe that the Great Pyramids were built to focus subtle energy and mental awareness in individuals who went through a methodical process of successive levels of initiation and ability until they were able to handle very, very high energy focusing in the Great Pyramid. And that, as is mentioned by many sort of psychics who, you know, tell tales of their lives or the lives of others in that time, that the Giza Plateau was basically a monastery, if you will, or a combination monastery convent, that it was where people went to learn to discover within themselves their own spiritual potentials, and that the pyramids and the other buildings around it were all a part of that process of initiation and process of self-discovery. And that there's tales told that the pharaohs were initiates, basically, that they had been through this, that the consciousness of the age was high enough that people wanted their leaders to be of higher consciousness than the norm, and that they were able to govern with a kind of wisdom and understanding that came from this inner awakening through the initiation process.
Okay. So Dwapara is an age that we are moving into. But before, let's go through the cycles and then let's get into specifics about the cycles. We're in Kali right now, which is probably the
lowest. No, we're in Dwapara.
Oh,
no, we're in
Dwapara.
Right
now. Okay.
Yes, now we moved into Dwapara in 1700.
Oh, excuse me.
That's why we're discovering things that are similar to what they knew in descending Dwapara.
Okay, so we're at the beginning of Dwapara, So Dwapara is how many years?
2400 years.
2400. Okay, and then after and Dwapara is considered the energy age, right?
Correct.
Okay. And then the next cycle is, and what we're going to do is we're going to go through the cycles real quickly, and then we're going to describe, well, what we can do is we can do a basic description. There's so much to cover in your book. I want to give people an understanding of these ages and the influence that man has, the gifts that he has as a conscious being and a physical being, and what we can predict or maybe surmise happened during these periods, because we're talking millions of years, correct?
Well, in Sri Yukteswar cycle, we're talking thousands of years.
Thousands of years. Okay, hundreds of thousands of years. Okay.
No, just the entire cycle is 24,000. So 12,000 from the lowest point to the highest point and back again. So the next age that we're talking about that is, depending on which way you're going, is after Dwapara, is what's called Treta Yuga, or the mental age. And the mental age in the past, the last one, lasted from 3100 BC to, got to get my math right here, I think it's 66 or 6700 BC. So 3,600 years going.
Okay.
So in terms of linear time, it's 6700 BC to 3100 BC. And this was the age, according to Sri Yukteswar, when man as a whole had more awareness of their thoughts. And this is where, when I explain this to most people, it gets harder to grasp. And Sri Yukteswar even says in his Holy Science that the general public would not inherently understand the mental age and then the next age beyond that, even the spiritual age. But I've tried to give some examples to people of what it would mean to have mental awareness. You know, we think of ourselves as, well, I just had a thought, I was aware of that thought. But we don't understand the power of our thought. And we're not aware of the results of our thoughts as much as we have the potential to do. And a fascinating example of how powerful our minds are is in the realm of what has been known as multiple personalities. I dipped into this a few years ago and became utterly fascinated with it. People who suffer from multiple personalities not only change very distinctively from one personality to another in sometimes a few minutes, sometimes a few hours, sometimes a few days. They move through these different personalities. But when they do, and this is less known by most people, when they move from one personality to another, they have physiological changes, physical changes in their bodies, as well as the personality changes. And some of them are quite dramatic. There are people who have one personality that has a mole, and the next personality does not. Some personalities need glasses.
Oh, I've heard about this.
And in fact, there are each personality needs a different prescription. There was one lady who suffered from this who carried a half a dozen different pairs of glasses in her purse because she never knew which one she was going to need next.
Yes, yes. Yeah,
each person is a distinct
level of consciousness.
Exactly. And when their shift happens, it's total. They are that person. And that's when you really understand the power of the mind, because in their mind, that body needs a certain type of glasses or doesn't need glasses. That body, in some cases, has different color eyes than other personalities, if you can imagine. And these switches, these changes, physiological changes, take place in moments from one to the next. So that gives us a glimpse of how powerful our mind is. And if we could consciously be aware and consciously use that power, according to Sri Yukteswar, we can manipulate the very atoms.
Mm-hmm.
And that he refers to this age as being a time when people are almost inconceivably powerful in comparison to the way they are now.
But the thing that's interesting about these ages, and a question for you is, doesn't the human consciousness also parallel or go with the environmental level of where they're at? In other words, the cosmic forces, the energy, the gravity, doesn't that change along with the human being so that they're imbued with a cosmic force that enhances their awareness, wouldn't you say?
Well, the way I would put it is it's not so much that we're changed by these cosmic forces, is that the instrument of our body becomes more refined. And as the instrument of our body becomes more refined, we are able to tune into subtler realities. The realities are always there. We're not suddenly becoming powerful mental beings. We are powerful mental beings. We just don't understand how to use that, and we're not very aware of it.
So you're saying through evolution, but through evolution, each generation, successive generation, becomes more aware. And it's like awareness grows and grows and grows and grows and grows, and then there's a decline, and it lessens and lessens and lessens. Is that how it works, basically?
Yes. Waxes and wanes, like the moon.
Waxes and wanes. Okay, that's fascinating. Now, the only thing I would say is that if you study the works of Alfredo Gamarra, who has a theory of the three worlds in South America, that's how he explains the unusual phenomenon of Cusco and Sacsayhuaman, which are massive ruins that have three types of distinct stonework. He believes that the Earth was in different phases of orbit around the sun, and the closer it was to the sun, the less the gravity, the bigger the human, and it may even explain why some of these extinct humanoid people had these long heads, these long craniums. And then the Earth, through whatever a cataclysm or through some cycle, is pushed away from the sun. That's a second cycle. And then the present cycle is we're even further out, the third cycle. And it all relates to the stonework. So I kind of see that potential in the yugas as a amplification, or maybe a way to support the body, but you're saying this is just all conscious awareness. Is that correct? Is what your understanding is?
One of the analogies I use that I find helpful is to think of the body as being a receiver, and that what you're receiving is like in a old-fashioned radio set. If you have a crystal in that old-fashioned radio set, it can only pull in a certain band of frequencies because that crystal is, fixed.
Right.
And that right now what we're pulling in as a civilization is we're pulling in understanding and thoughts from this great cosmic sea of consciousness in which we're a part. We're just pulling in those things that have to do with learning about subtle energy and energy, because that's the frequency range that we can perceive right now. But cycle goes forward, then we're going to become, our instruments, our physical bodies, will become more and more refined. And they might also, this may be another explanation for what you were alluding to, as we become more and more refined, we may also literally become lighter. I do know that there are fairly convincing digs that have been done indicating that there were, in fact, giants in the past. And as modern science would have it today, it's a very impractical thing to have such a large body. But it may, in fact, be that over the millennia, while this refinement goes on, is that there's not so much the gravity changes, is that the density of the human body may become finer and finer. That's just pure speculation on my part, but it would fit the fact that there have been these giants found in the past. And whether that matches up to them being able to move and manipulate larger and larger stonework, I don't know. I would tend to favor that their mental powers and their subtle energy powers are really the answer to that, that they are able to move huge blocks of stones and manipulate huge blocks of stones with ease, because they're not relying on physical means. They're not relying on muscles and levers and ropes and that sort of thing, that they literally can levitate them, maybe even okay. In the highest ages, they can manifest them.
Okay.
So just to finish the four ages, let me just touch on.
Yeah,
the
I want to get to the final, the most amazing age, which is Satya. So go ahead and then we'll get into some specifics regarding some of these anomalies, which are fascinating, and the consciousness behind them. So go ahead.
Spiritual age is the last and longest. It's 4,800 years of the 12,000. So Satya is 48, Treta is 36, Dwapara is 2,400, and then Kali, the lowest age, is 1,200. So the Satya Yuga era is, its characteristic is spiritual awareness, that the majority of people alive in those eras would naturally and easily be aware of their own spiritual nature, that they're connected to this vast sea of consciousness, and that they would have all the awareness of the Treta Yuga man's mental awareness and the Dwapara Yuga man's energy awareness and the Kali Yuga man's physical awareness, but their primary awareness, that what they most tune into, is what we would call spiritual awareness. And
okay.
In this time, we would expect there to be not very much need for what we think of as the, you know, the basics, food and shelter and defense, because they're living in an age where they can manifest food, the weather is harmonious, people are harmonious, and that in during these eras, these Satya Yuga eras, there's probably very little constructed in the massive way that we see, the massive way that we see later in the cycle with, you know, the Egyptian ruins and the megalithic period, etc.
Okay. What would be an example of a ruin from Satya period? Do you have any idea?
Well, the one that I think is most fascinating right now is Göbekli Tepe.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find most fascinating about it, not only is it the oldest structure that we are aware of, you know, significant structure, isn't a habitation, and it isn't a defensive fort. They appear to be some kind of these circles. The Göbekli Tepe ruins are circles with loose walls around them. They're open roofed. There was no covering, but they appear to be sacred spaces. They appear to be ceremonial or purely spiritual in their purpose. There's no evidence around Göbekli Tepe of habitation, let alone in the circles. People came here for very, very high purposes in comparison to the kind of ruins that are, you know, come later in history. And
yes.
to compound the mystery, they were in use for a couple of thousand years. Estimates vary exactly on how long it was from the beginning to when they stopped being used. But we know pretty clearly when they stopped being used because they were deliberately covered, which doesn't fit at all the notion of a hunter-gatherer kind of consciousness building them. Why would they bother to fill them in after taking all the trouble to build them?
Exactly.
You can speculate that perhaps they were power centers of some kind and they needed to be covered because they were too powerful. Difficult to know at this remove, but it's certainly not the behavior of super primitive men, which is what mainstream archaeology would have us believe was
right.
The case. It's a highly sophisticated awareness that we see expressing in that build.
Right, and the peak time for Satya is 11,500 BC.
Correct.
So that is the height of the spiritual age, and so in the spiritual age, the differentiation between that and the mental age is what? Is it more? If the mental age has one level of consciousness, what is the predicted spiritual age consciousness? Is it real kind of meditative? Is it? I think I read somewhere that it's. Isn't there a telepathy is used quite a bit?
That was also, according to Sri Yukteswar, true of the mental age, that telepathy would be the normal way in which people communicated.
Okay.
So by extension, we can say that it would also be the norm in the spiritual age. I think that the biggest difference is that in the spiritual age, people would be more aware of their oneness with everything. That their spiritual awareness is really about being a part of this ocean of consciousness. Where in the mental age, there would still be more of a sense of individuality, of separateness, even though they're extremely powerful beings, they would be sort of coming from a sense of their unique self rather than trying to become part of and kind of dissolve that unique self into this infinite consciousness.
But the thing that's unique between those ages, the mental and the spiritual age, the Satya and the Treta, is that it seems that the Satya is less interested in building these megaliths, massive megaliths like the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx that we now know is significantly older than what the Egyptologists tell us. In fact, Shark and John Anthony West both believe that it's between 5,000 to 7,000 years older than which would throw it into Treta, I believe, Tritia.
Right.
So. But the thing that I'm curious about, and maybe you can explain to me, is if the spiritual age is unique in that the consciousness is more subtle. I mean, we can't even understand what their perception of what the world and reality is. But it doesn't seem if a Göbekli Tepe is an example of their civic center or their sacred center. It's not huge like the pyramid or like the Sphinx. So perhaps there isn't a need to build these gigantic structures, or it could be that we haven't found a really good example. But your example is Göbekli Tepe. What do you say to that? You think there is a possibility that the spiritual age is building in a different manner, obviously, or I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, I think it's very possible that there are things left behind in those higher ages that we're yet to find.
Okay.
And I also think there may be things left over from those past ages that are staring us in the face, but we don't really appreciate them for what they are. And they may have moved things on a scale that we just can't even comprehend. Rather than moving large stones, maybe they rearranged the landscape. They terraformed, you know, the earth, and it's just so huge that it's unbelievable that that could have been by, you know, sort of human agency. I don't have any concrete examples of that, but I think with the kind of powers that Sri Yukteswar ascribes to people in those times, that's possible. But I think mainly what they were interested in was not leaving their mark on the earth, but transforming themselves ever more deeply into attunement to this ocean of consciousness, as I like to call it, of which we all are a part. Now, there's some other record left behind that isn't a physical record of Satyayuga, and that is the great body of mythic lore that has come down through all ancient cultures. And when they describe in these myths the golden age, as the Greeks would have it, or Satyayuga, they really equate it with paradise, and that it was a time when, you know, the lion laid down with the lamb and harmony reigned. People shone like the sun. They were, they could fly. They could levitate. So we have descriptions of how they lived, if you will, but not so much a physical archaeological record like we do with later ages.
Okay. So, I mean, the book itself has been it's highlighted, and it's you have people like Graham Hancock and Robert Schock and a number of well-known people who are studying ancient unknown civilizations. And what the book helped me with is clarify how some of these societies, how these people thought, and maybe not necessarily thought, but what the world was like when they built their structures. So, of course, conventional science will look at this and go, well, it's a nice story, but, you know, where's the proof? Linking the two is the real chore. I want to read a passage from your book here in the introduction, and I want you to explain it for me. You say this. You say, this is just a short a part. Today, we are on the brink of another major conceptual change. This time, not in the field of physics, but in the field of history and the development of civilization. Just as Einstein overturned conventional thinking due to anomalous but undefinable fact that the speed of light is constant, history and archaeology are similarly confronted with undeniable anomalies that are beginning to overturn conventional thinking about the course of man's development. That is a very profound statement. What do you mean by that? Tell me what you mean.
Well, I think that we've touched on a lot of it. Just the Great Pyramids alone are an obvious standout proof that what archaeologists think about the ancient past just doesn't add up. The pyramids are just too sophisticated for a civilization that they say is just emerging from the Stone Age to have built. The accuracy of the building alone belies that notion that a primitive group of people just kind of still banging rocks together could have designed it and built it, whatever its purpose was. And then you have Göbekli Tepe, which is a standout that does not fit the linear development notion that we've evolved from hunter-gatherers in the last 10 to 15,000 years. The Vedas are a extremely interesting standout anomaly They're just far too sophisticated for something that goes back 5 or 6,000 years, unless things were more sophisticated 5 or 6,000 years ago. The Vedas are, and Sanskrit in particular, is even today the most exact, the most precise, the most logically consistent language on Earth. And it probably is 9,000 years old at a minimum.
Yes.
So there are just too many things like that that don't add up. And I think that we're seeing with the people you mentioned, Graham Hancock, Robert Schock, and a number of others who are pushing the frontier of what is understood about the ancient past, and new, what's generally referred to as the new archaeology, is applying technology testing to existing finds and are determining that these things are far older than they're popularly believed. So it's a combination of the time is being pushed back, the anomalies are becoming more sharply defined, and at some point here, I can't predict for you when, but at some point here, they're going to reach a tipping point where they have no choice but to redefine how the past came about.
Well, that's my next question to you is. When does conventional science sync up with ancient Vedic literature, the Yugas? I mean, does it have to be so in their face? Atlantis is discovered. We hear about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Maybe it's the Atlantean scrolls are found in Peru somewhere. I mean, there's always the problem with disinformation. Now it's coming out that the Smithsonian has been hiding documents for, if not 50, close to 100 years. But what is your feeling about the changing and the acceptance over much older cycles in man's history?
Well, I think it comes down to a big dose of human nature. There's just a lot of people whose careers and livelihoods depend on maintaining the status quo. And I think human nature just is what it is. They're not going to let go of that easily. But there will reach a point, you know, my favorite example is the point of change about whether the continents drifted or not. Right up until the 1940s, even though there were some obvious reasons to think the continents might drift around on the surface of the planet, nobody really accepted that that could be the case because they couldn't understand how it was possible that continents could move. And then in the 40s and early 50s, there were some discoveries made and everything clicked. And by the late 1950s, it was just commonly accepted that the continents moved and that it explained all sorts of things that had just been sort of put on various shelves that nobody could really explain until they accepted this. So at some point, I think we're going to have a tip, but I can't predict to you with any real confidence when that would happen. But I know there's a lot being discovered. I mean, just about every article you read about archaeology or paleontology has as a theme that it's not what they thought and it's older than they thought. So at some point, that's all going to, you know, accumulate and it's going to shift.
Okay. So we're down to a last couple of minutes. I wanted to ask you, following the completion of your book, you're David Steinmetz. Is there anything that, other than Göbekli Tepe, is there anything that kind of justifies, or not, that's probably the wrong word to use, but clarifies the content of the yugas? And is there a discovery out there that you feel confident is kind of a beginning of unveiling of this ancient unknown past?
Well, you know, what I did in my book is I tried to look at what's already known and what's already discovered and what's, you know, what are the facts and peel away the interpretation of the facts that is right now. The interpretation is that development was linear, that it was Darwinian, that we went from primitive to our current state of the highest advancement. And I just took away that interpretation and looked at the facts. And no one fact jumped out and said, this can't be explained any other way. But when I put all of the facts into a new interpretation, I came away feeling very, 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 very confident that they fit, those facts fit the new interpretation of there being a cycle far better than they fit the interpretation that it was linear. Mm-hmm. And so I would say if I had to, you know, try to support my contention that the yugas are true in any single way, I would say look at the whole. Look at the footprint that goes back for thousands upon thousands of years, and I think you will find that the footprint fits this cycle and these stages of development far better than it does anything else.
Okay, excellent. Well, I have to tell you, as a researcher, I find solace in the yugas because it helps me explain anomalies. And I am a researcher in Central and South America. That's where my focus is. And I find that the Mayas as a culture are misunderstood, and I believe that they are much, much, much older than science has given them to. I mean, there's some archaeologists out there that are considered turn-of-the-century people that have said that the Maya go back 10,000 years. But it's not being shown currently because it would screw up and change current theories of historical past. So, but anyhow, the book's called The Yugas, Keys to Understanding Our Hidden Past, Emerging Energy Age and the Enlightened Future. The author, our guest today, was Joseph Selby, and he co-wrote the book with David Steinmetz. It's a fascinating book. I recommend all my listeners, everyone, to go out and get it. And it's very well written. It's very thorough. It's a fairly easy read, but it's not something you can sit down and read in a weekend. You have to sit with it. In fact, I am beginning my second reading of it because it is packed with great information. So, Joseph, thank you very much for being my guest today.
You're very welcome. Let me just put in a quick comment that I'm going to be at the CPAC conference in Rancho Mirage down around the Palm Springs area in mid-October. And it's a conference focused on not the yugas only, but on many of the subjects that we've touched on. Robert Schock will be there. Amit Goswami will be there. A number of other extremely knowledgeable speakers on these subjects. And I look forward to being there and hearing them. If you want to know more about it, go to CPAC, C-P-A-K. .com or CPAConline.com, I think it is, to find out more.
Okay. And what is your, what's the web address for the yugas and what some of your background so people can read about what you're doing and the book itself?
Yes. If they want to learn more about that, it's the usual www.theyugas.com.
Fantastic. All right. Fantastic. Well, thank you, David, and I appreciate you being on the program. So next week, don't forget, we will be discussing DNA of the Gods with Chris Hardy. She'll be calling in from France. That'll be a live program. And that is the latest information. She is a PhD in ethnopsychology, but she is also a cognitive scientist, and she takes some of the information from she's carrying forward Zachariah Sitchin's book and his work on some of the myths and some of the information that she's discovered. So that is our program for this week.